Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In New York yesterday, alone in his Manhattan office, a top money manager apparently slit his wrists in despair over the billion-plus dollars he lost with Bernard Madoff. You don't have to have lost billions to be in need of a little hope these days. It can look pretty tough out there. And yet, hope stirs in the light of a Christmas tree, a menorah, an election, a determination to go on in hope. This hour on Point, we're looking straight at hope in hard times, at what it is, how it works, where we find it. You can join the conversation. Are you feeling hopeful these days despite everything? Are you despairing? Is there strong hope and weak hope? And where do you find yours? We have a great pair of thinkers with us today and very honored to have them. Joining me first from Chicago is Martin E. Marty, one of America's most honored theologians. He's professor emeritus at the University of Chicago Divinity School. He's been a pastor in the Lutheran Church since 1952. He's the author of more than 50 books, including Our Hope for Years to Come, The Search for Spiritual Sanctuary. Martin, Marty, welcome back. It's been a long time. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be back.
Also with me in the studio is Dr. Jerome Groopman, professor at Harvard Medical School and chief of experimental medicine at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. He's a pathbreaking researcher in AIDS and cancer and a celebrated author and writer for The New Yorker magazine. His big 2003 book was The Anatomy of Hope. Jerry Groopman, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks so much to both of you for being with us. What a season we're in. Martin, Marty, are you feeling it out there? Are you feeling the hope or the despair? What's your barometer right now?
Well, culturally, socially, politically, of course, there are good reasons not to find hope coming easily. And yet, the closer you are to people, including those, most of those who are suffering, you find they're more ready to talk about hope than they were when things were going well. If I can spend 30 more seconds, mm-hmm. I'll choose a poem that has always helped me frame
please,
this.
Please.
W.H. Auden wrote it at the end of World War II. We thought we had everything and then came war. Now it seems to me we thought we had everything figured out and then came 9/11 and insecurity. We thought we had everything figured out financially and then came the crash. And at the end of his little poem, Auden says, we were able to bury our dead and still able to say we're children of God and our Father's never forsaken us. And then he goes on, but then we were children. Now we're less innocent. That was a moment ago before an outrageous novelty had been introduced into our lives. Why were we never warned? And then he says, perhaps we were. And I think we're waking up now to retrieving hope when all the warning signals didn't help us.
Jerome Groopman, what about it? Then we were children. Now we're less innocent. Is hope only for children?
No, actually, I think it's useful to distinguish between hope and optimism. Mm-hmm. An optimist says everything's going to work out just fine. Everything is going to be great. And when you're an adult, you know that that's not how the world works, and often things don't work out for the best. Mm-hmm. True hope is different. Hope sees all of the problems, all of the obstacles, all of the pitfalls, all the opportunities for failure. But through all of that, with a clear eye, it sees a path to a better future. And that's why I think true hope is so fundamental, particularly in times of crisis, whether it be social crisis, economic crisis, war, extreme circumstances of illness.
So when you look at people who are expressing hope and you're assessing which kind of hope they're expressing, how do you judge whether they're onto a kind of, you know, tough-tempered, tested hope or something closer to just wishful optimism?
I engage them in a conversation. I ask them what they see in front of them. If they tell me, oh, everything's fine, there are no problems, sure, the cancer will go away, or, oh, yes, I'm sure I'll recoup all my money in the stock market or whatever, you know they're deluding themselves, mm-hmm. and that's not true hope. The reason that true hope is so powerful is that by being clear-eyed, you can make very smart decisions because you know what's really in front of you. There's no guarantee, but it's tremendously uplifting and energizing.
But what does clear-eyed mean in a world where there are so many bummers, where there are so many negatives, so many pitfalls, so many diseases, so many honest reasons for despair?
There is plenty of reason for despair. There's actually, from the Jewish tradition, an injunction. It is forbidden to despair, meaning to only despair. And what you do is you say, okay, how might I recoup myself financially? Do I need to change my job? Do I need to invest in a more stable or secure kind of instrument, keep my money in the bank, divest of my credit card, whatever? In the case of illness, yes, I have this terrible cancer, but is there a treatment? Is there a possibility for me to take a drug, an experimental drug? No guarantee, but does have a realistic possibility of helping. And that reinforces a sense of true hope and allows you to make the best decision you can, again, without guarantee, but it certainly enriches your life.
Martin Marty in Chicago, I jumped into a car a couple of months ago. Rush Limbaugh was on the radio. And this was, of course, in the run-up to the elections. And he was on a tremendous Rush Limbaughian riff against hope, just mocking hope, talking, bad-mouthing hope. Hope is for losers. Hope is ridiculous. Hope is for people who don't have real hard plans. Hope is, you know, hope is lame. Hope is weak. Hope is wan. What about all that? Maybe hope is for fools, as Rush Limbaugh says.
Well, then he's a fool, because everything he said smashes everything that's important to humanity. In Christianity, it's faith and hope and love, and hope is in the middle of them, and it's always linked to the other two. And if you give up on hope, you've given up on faith, and most of all, you've given up on love. What I liked in what Dr. Groopman said, several things. One, he started by saying, I converse with patients. In other words, hope is a transaction. When you're really alone, if you have a terminal illness, that's being alone is as bad as pain. And when there's a conversation partner, a friend, a lover, a child, anybody, you begin to get part of what I also heard him saying. You get to be part of a narrative, part of a story, and thus part of a community. And most of all, I like the way he immediately turned away from optimism and hope. They don't fit together at all, because optimism knows of a certain outcome, and if it doesn't happen, then you're shattered. So the realism, and I think I'm a Christian theologian, and I can't let Christmas go by without at least quoting one line from one of the best-known songs. Phyllis Brooks, your fellow Bostonian, wrote a long time ago,
yes,
O Little Town of Bethlehem. I like the line where he says, you know, upon your dark street shineth the everlasting light. The hopes and fears of all the years are met in thee tonight. In other words, if you're hoping, you better also be aware that there are malign forces out there. You got a little baby that could easily die. A lot of mothers die in childbirth. All that's happening. And the people who sing the songs about it and give gifts in the light of it are part of it. And they're also not turning away from others. The word about that we heard from Dr. Groopman about in Judaism, you're not allowed to despair. Christians also borrow from Judaism and graft onto it the prophetic sense. My favorite theologian, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, defined prophecy as hope projected backward. The Hebrew prophets were extremely realistic. Everything had gone wrong, but they always talked about a remnant. They always talked about the day of the Lord, and you can get your life in order, and you can do justice and love mercy. And I think that's what counters it. And therefore, if somebody on the radio wants to smash hope, he's thereby smashed faith and love and the future.
Of course, hope was very much in the politics of this season. Barack Obama named his book The Audacity of Hope, and he talked a lot about it on the campaign trail, responded to just that kind of Rush Limbaugh notion on March 1st in Providence, Rhode Island. He said that he talks about hope, but many people may be confused about what he meant.
See, the critics, the cynics don't understand what hope is. Hope is not blind optimism. Hope is not ignorance of the challenge that stand between you and your dreams. Hope is exactly the opposite. Hope is believing and then working, then fighting for things.
Barack Obama, March 1st this year. Martin Marty, here's a Chicagoan from your backyard. What do you make of the Obama brand of hope?
Well, there are a lot of brands out there, and I think it was wonderful that he gave voice to what is in the minds of so many people, and he tied it to practicality. It's fun to me to watch him form a cabinet, and some people are saying there's not enough ideology. There's not enough philosophy of exactly how it's going to work. He's bipartisan. He's picking all kinds of people. Well, he's a pragmatist, which is what good hopers are. They surround you with plan and program, but most of all, and here I'm going to go back to something Dr. Grootman said, you stimulate imagination. That's the big part. You imagine futures. You try this, you try that. And I think that's as true of somebody in a terminal illness in a hospice where the family is gathered as it is of people who have a little baby, for those who come singing their carols about Jesus. I don't care who it is. They combine imagination and practicality.
Not just optimism. You had an essay last year, The Recovery of Hope, you called it. You quoted a poem, The Optimist. The optimist fell 10 stories. As he passed each window bar, he shouted in to his comrades, "It's all right so far." I guess that's not what you're talking about.
Indeed.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about hope in hard times, where it comes from, how it works, what it means. I'm joined by Dr. Jerome Grootman, author of The Anatomy of Hope. He's with me in the studio today, writer for The New Yorker and physician and researcher in AIDS and cancer. Martin Marty joins us from Chicago, famous theologian, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago Divinity School, author of many books, including Our Hope, For Years to Come, The Search for Spiritual Sanctuary. Here's a little bit more from candidate Barack Obama. At that same speech, Providence, Rhode Island, March 1st, 2008, he said hope had been crucial in American history from the time of the Revolution forward.
That is how slaves and abolitionists resisted an evil system and how a new president charted a course to ensure we would not remain half slave and half free. They had hope. That is how immigrants traveled from distant shores. That is how pioneers went west. That's how the greatest generation, my grandfather fighting in Patton's army in World War II, my grandmother staying behind with a baby, working on a bomber assembly line, that greatest generation defeating Hitler and fascism and lifting itself up out of a Great Depression. Hope.
Out of the Great Depression, says Barack Obama, little did we know what we might be thinking about at the end of this same year. Dr. Jerome Grootman and Martin Marty are with us. Carol Ann's calling right now from Brooklyn, Connecticut. Carol Ann, you're on the air.
Well, hello, Tom, and happy Christmas.
Thank you so much.
I am always reminded when we're talking of hope of something that L.A. Wiesel said at a lecture at Boston University. He said, to hope is to stave off chaos. And I think that's one of the most wonderful things I've ever heard.
To hope is to stave off chaos. It's beautiful. How do you interpret it, Carol Ann?
Well, that even when things look the dimmest, that as long as we can keep ourselves looking forward, looking hopeful, then we will somehow get through, as he certainly proved.
With all of his Holocaust experience. Caroline, thank you very much for bringing that to us. Jerome Grootman, it's the Christmas season. It's the Hanukkah season. One of my producers was talking with Rabbi Keith Stern at Temple Beth of Odah in just outside Boston here. And he was talking about Hanukkah, the menorah, the candles, and how there had been this debate between famous Jewish scholars, Shammai and Hillel, over whether you should start with all eight candles and sort of put them out. Shammai was saying, or Hillel, start with one and let them light up to eight. Hillel, one out. Hope in that way.
Yes, I think there are two things. One is the caller points out hope gives you a sense of control. And again, it's not illusory because you have a plan. You have a strategy. You've seen a path. As Martin Marty said, it sparks imagination. And with imagination comes action. And I do think it's a beautiful debate between these two great Talmudic rabbis, that the light increases, that you can begin with a very small flicker, and that then that small illumination allows you to increase the light. And again, without delusion or without any sense that it's all guaranteed, to sort of reflect also, you know, you don't have to be religious. You don't have to be a person of faith, clearly, to have mm-hmm. this kind of hope. Mm-hmm. And if you look at leaders who spoke in a secular vein, I don't know about their personal religious beliefs, but Winston Churchill, mm-hmm. In the middle of the Battle of Britain, said to the English people, "I have nothing to give you but blood, sweat, toil, and tears." He didn't say everything's going to be great.
Right, right, right.
But they endured and prevailed.
He called for hope there. Even when things look difficult, in fact, things are very difficult. The human condition itself, a very difficult thing. Martin Marty, I'm reminded of Antonio Gramsci, the Italian philosopher. He talked about pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will. Does that resonate with you?
Yes, pessimism of the intellect. If you just add up everything, including the financial crisis and the war and the pictures that one sees on television of the children in Sudan and Somalia, you know, you add up all that, the burden of that, you'd simply be defeated. And yet, in the midst of it, there are humanitarian workers, there are politicians and economists who don't have a very good name right now in this crisis. There are all kinds of people that are trying to build along the way. But I think what I hope is coming through from both of us mm-hmm. is that hope is not just talk about one single individual, just when the last little bit of air of the life raft is going out, going under, and then you should hope. I think we're talking about the community in which it happens. We're talking about the nation. We're talking about globalization. We're talking about classes of people and orders of people. And I think that's why Gramsci, whom you quoted, was so interested. He was a very radically left social mm-hmm. philosopher.
Right.
You don't have to be that to get there. I think the other thing that I want to pick up from my partner this morning mm-hmm. is we should spend a moment on this. I think most people in the world who have hope, at least in the prophetic religion parts of the world, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, mm-hmm. The word is they focus on God. Hinduism, too. I don't know about Buddhism. But there's something innate in the human factor that you look ahead. A quick story, since we brought up Holocaust, a story told by Dr. Viktor Frankl, the great psychiatrist in the camps. He went through the camp experience. Mm-hmm. And he said he observed that there were people who knew that they were going to be killed that night, and yet they shared their last piece of bread with someone else who would maybe be killed soon. Maximilian Kolbe, a Catholic priest, who gave up his space, he was going to be killed, and he turned it over to a man who survived, maybe for a day or so, because the man had children, and this caused empathy in Kolbe. Well, my hunch is, knowing what we know about the Holocaust, is that Kolbe knew that that man was going to be killed too. But it was in him, and he was serving his God. He was serving the faith that had been in him. And even the telling of the story is profitable to us so much later, even though he certainly was killed.
But that brings us to the bleakest circumstances and makes me wonder, what's the difference between simple humanity and hope? There wasn't really much hope of escaping their fate. Well, one man shares bread with another and both are essentially condemned. Is that hope or is that empathy?
Well, I'm going to toss this in and then turn it over. Mm-hmm. Back when I made that crack about Rush Limbaugh, I said, if you kill off hope, you've killed off faith and love, you've killed off humanity. In other words, I'm arguing that it is an essential feature of sentient, alert human beings to hope. And when you dash that and belittle it and make fun of it, you are murdering.
An essential element of even life. This gets into your realm, Dr. Groopman.
Well, I think going back before the prophetic religions or contemporaneous, it's interesting. I didn't know the full scope of the Pandora myth. And I use this as the epigraph.
In Pandora's Box.
Pandora's Box. So mm-hmm. I always thought it meant that Pandora, who was the first mortal woman, had been given this box and that she was curious and opened it up. She was told not to. and all of the evils escape from the box into the world, all the troubles. Mm-hmm. So we use the term Pandora's box. Mm-hmm. But it turns out that the myth also included the fact that within Pandora's box were all of the blessings that were given to humans.
And they escaped as well?
They escaped except for one. And that one blessing was hope, because the Greeks believed that without hope, human beings could not endure. So I think what Martin Marty is saying, goes back in time and is very fundamental to the human condition and the human psyche, that we need hope to live, to endure, and hopefully to prevail.
Let's go to Breanne calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Breanne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thank you so much. I love your show.
Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. What's on your mind, Breanne?
Okay, great. Well, when I think of hope, I think of, for me, what feels like the opposite, which is despair or anxiety or fear. And not only with the circumstances and the challenges that we face globally or in our country, but also in my own life. And if I look back over my whole life, there's always been times where I felt deeply challenged, and I always feel like I have a choice. You know, I can lean on the side of anxiety and despair, or I could lean on the side of hope. And while it's not always easy to do, in a way, it's sort of like a disciplined mind. You know, I have to discipline myself, and that's one part. And the other part is I just feel like I don't have control over everything. So I have, in some ways, I feel like I have control over very little, myself. Mm-hmm. And
But hope as a discipline gives you a sense of strength, of agency, of choice, even the choice just to have that discipline.
Exactly. And it helps to have, I'm a big Obama supporter, it helps to have this great leader coming around in January. That definitely helps me
feel
more hopeful.
We've got your witness right there, and we appreciate it. Keep up that discipline. And let me get another call right here, if I may, from East Providence, Rhode Island. Christine, you're on the air.
Oh, yes. Hi. Thanks, Tom. And it's an honor to be on. I've called before, and you'll recognize perhaps my topics, but I haven't said before that I have metastatic cancer, and I also recently had an operation, so I've been unable to drive or anything since the middle of August, and, you know, now it's just before Christmas. Mm. So my greatest joy is people, and, of course, I really appreciate what one of the gentlemen said, which was that loneliness can be as bad as pain, and that's where hope gets problematic, because if people give you such joy and hope, but you can't control them, it's a very difficult place to be so that you don't become alone, especially with email, which I don't find fun. You don't hear people's laughter, et cetera. So there are some substitutes today for, you know, common ground that I don't find really help the loneliness.
But real community may be necessary to bring that hope to life, to stand it up.
Yep. And what I have found, though, I've been working on, and it's helped me through this so much, is, and this is where I've called before, I've been doing my genealogy for the last, I think, 5 years. And I didn't really realize that my father's family was African-American until about 5 years ago. I started to suspect. My parents had both died, and my brother had passed away. And I'm finding this whole ancestry with people, the struggles that they went through, because I'm reading about the history as well. I've met several second cousins once removed by phone only, but they've done all sorts of research, so they've been able to put me even more in touch with the amazing people that have been in my past.
So
that my grandmother told us, but I converted it to our being a white family, not knowing we were a black family on all sides, all the way back. So to see the history of this country now, from this personal standpoint, and to have these people and their life situations and their hopefulness, especially because one gentleman, actually two gentlemen, really were early civil rights activists during the Reconstruction.
Isn't that something? And that genealogy and their trials in your hour of need coming through for you, letting you build a kind of community backward in time and draw in some ways just on the fact of generations hanging in there. Christine, you hang in there, and thank you for calling. Martin, Marty, there's community in Christine's case reaching back in time, reaching across generations and bolstering hope.
Well, I think one thing that I drew from hers and I drew from President-elect Obama's is that in the face of many kinds of circumstances, including slavery, some years ago, Eugene Genovese, who was at that time a Marxist historian, wrote a book called Roll, Jordan, Roll, in which he started out with a Marxist revolutionary impulse to say, well, the slaves were so stupid, they didn't rebel, they didn't revolt, and that's it. And the more he read about it, he said, well, first of all, revolt wouldn't have done anything.
Sounds like we lost Martin Marty for a second there. Jerome Groopman, you hear Christine's testimony, and you know very well about people struggling with pathology, with disease, cancer in her
right.
case.
And I think the two points here, one, the sense of community and people around, it reminds me of a patient who had metastatic mm-hmm. cancer, breast mm-hmm. cancer, actually. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I came to her bedside and I said to her, I said, Elizabeth, you know, I have no more medicine to give you. And she said, no, you're wrong. And I said, well, what do you mean? She said, you have the medicine of friendship. Mm-hmm. And it was a very profound experience because you realize that there's hope not just on a physical or clinical level, but on an emotional, psychological, spiritual level. And a lot of that comes from relationships and the importance of relationships. And in terms of genealogy also, I think that what you have is you have a sense of narrative, of story, that you've come, you're here, and yet you're linked through time, as you said, Tom, with others who have struggled and ultimately prevailed.
But what about the actual real importance, strength of hope? I mean, some came back when you wrote the book, The Anatomy of Hope, some in the medical world and said, you know what? Amnesia is as good as hope. Anesthetic is good. Forget about your pain. Hope can be overrated.
Well, I think that part of that is that hope can become a cliche, and you have to be careful. There are unscientific, really misleading testimonies out there, you know, that, oh, you know, if you just think positively and align your mind in the right way, your cancer will miraculously shrink or lupus will go away. If mm-hmm. you laugh mm-hmm. and you're happy and you watch Groucho Marx, one famous person said, you know, his autoimmune disease disappeared. Well, you know, I've never seen that in 35 years, and I don't think that's documented. But hope is very powerful biologically, in terms of pain, in terms of motor or muscle control.
Your research has been about how blood cells communicate.
Blood cells communicate.
Does hope make them chatter or not? I mean, is it that clear
No, in that way, it would be an overstatement. No mm-hmm. one really knows. Mm-hmm. But there are really good data with regard to pain and motor control. And when actually you reduce pain as a person who is ill, that gives you almost more space in your mind and more energy to think in a productive way. So it's not wishful thinking. It's very pragmatic, like we've been saying through the course of the morning.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about hope in hard times, where it comes from, how it works, what it means. Dr. Jerome Groopman is here. He's author of The Anatomy of Hope. And from Chicago, we're joined by theologian Martin Marty, author of Our Hope for Years to Come, The Search for Spiritual Sanctuary. Let's go to Leesburg, Virginia, and Jawad. Jawad, you're on the air.
Hello, everybody. Happy holidays. I'm really glad to be here today. I want to talk about another aspect of hope here, which is the mystical and spiritual of hope when you're a child.
The mystical, okay.
And I can tell you about my personal experience. I was born in 1985 in the midst of Cold War, And at age one, I was affected by polio. So in 1998, you know, I was 13 years old, completely illiterate, and the country in total war.
Where were you growing up, Jawad?
I was growing up in Kabul City, Afghanistan.
Okay.
And my parents were totally worried about me, what's going to happen, the kid is not going to school and so on. Mm-hmm. But I was, you know, in the back of my mind and in my heart, you know, there was something telling me that everything will be all right, and that I will be able to prevail all the problems ahead of me. But the good thing was that I was really curious, and I was trying to find every way possible to teach myself. And finally, things worked out. You know, I went to college in Italy and came to America. Just graduated from college.
From a 13-year-old with polio in Kabul in the midst of war, it's a long journey. And this mystical hope that you felt, was it practical? Was it beyond the practical? I guess it was, if it's mystical.
Yeah, I guess it was something that I didn't realize at the time. But now when I go back to my experience and see how did I did what I did and how did I survive all the problems, you know, that's the closest explanation that I come up with. Because, you know, when I looked at the problems back then, and, you know, if I were like a total, you know, like an economist or a mathematician,
right.
You know, the probability of, you know, solving all these problems were, you know, near zero. But, I mean, there was something in my heart that was telling me that you're going to be able to overcome all these problems and you shouldn't worry. I was really curious. I was doing all that I could. I was not sitting you know, at home and thinking that something will happen on its own.
Magically, right.
You know? Yeah, but I think the point is that, you know, hope is really meaningful when it's accompanied with action, when it's like genuine, and, you know, when it's not just a kind of rhetoric and, you know, people...
Absolutely. Jawad, it's a powerful story, and thank you very much for sharing it. You know, Martin Marty, I'm looking here at a line Jawad makes me think of, and this is kind of maybe the opposite view, I'm not sure. This is from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam 1,000 years ago, and it says, "The worldly hope men set their hearts upon turns ashes, or it prospers, and anon, like snow upon the desert's dusty face, lighting a little hour or two, is gone." So it may work, it may not, but it comes and it goes. It doesn't seem to have such faith there in the Rubaiyat in hope, and yet for Jawad, it's just about all he had with polio as a kid in war-torn Afghanistan.
Well, you'll find things like the Rubaiyat in the Book of Lamentations, in the Book of Job, and many places in the Psalms. It's never the last word in the biblical canon, but realism is it. I mean, when you hope, you're not saying, "I know I'm never going to die." You're going to die. When you hope, it doesn't mean you're never going to have accidents or contingencies. You're always part of it. When you say, "I hope," it doesn't mean that 1,000 years from now somebody's going to be able to look up my genealogy record. It'll be gone. Those three things, finitude, you're going to die, contingency, they're accidents, transience, things pass, are there before you begin other kinds of hoping. But now I want to get right back to one thing Joad said very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I want to change the word mystical to mystery. I once wrote a book called The Mystery of the Child, based on a French philosopher's distinction between a problem and a mystery. A problem has a potential solution. He says you lay siege to it. But a mystery, the deeper you go, the more there's there. And that's where I think the sense of the transcendent, the faith in God, for me, God in Jesus of Bethlehem, that's a mystery. I can't explain it logically, but I can go deeper. And I think here's where I think Dr. Gutman's first word about the child fits well. There's a French novelist, Georges Bernanos, who once said, "The most terrifying word ever heard by human ears was when Jesus said, 'Unless you change and become like a child, you'll never enter the kingdom.'" And the childlikeness of faith is nurtured in community. We support each other. In practice, we need a whole political party. We need three branches of government. We need volunteer groups. We need all that. But always key to it is you keep some of that sense of wonder. And I've seen that in terminally ill people who sometimes pass comfort to the people who have come to comfort them.
Dr. Gruttmann, I wonder if hard times themselves sometimes spark hope. In some sense, I've been feeling this lately as though, you know, in the 90s, everything was booming along. We were buying and spending and, you know, not a care in the world. There's a kind of lack of self-awareness that can come into play when you're on that path. And lately, things are tough, but people almost feel like they're shedding irrelevancies and girding for action, for to really come to grips with some realities that are easier to avoid in good times.
Well, there's an interesting line that comes to mind from Theodore Rothko, who said that in a dark time, the eye begins to see. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like when we enter into a dark room, our pupil adjusts and our eye adjusts, and we become more sensitive and more discerning to what's there. And I think that that is true, that all the distractions and the sort of easy materialism, not that there isn't real pain going on and serious economic difficulties, but it does cause people to turn not only inward, but to those that they love and to really find what's substantial.
Let's go to Rob in Boston. Rob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
When I was in high school a long time ago, we read a book called, I believe it was by Martin Buber, called Man's Search for Meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And it was about, I can be correct on that, it was about his experiences in a concentration camp. And the part of the book that struck me and is still with me today is when he looks, it's a pretty hopeless situation that he's in, and he looks out the window and he sees a tree, and what that inspires in him is the realization, I guess the hope, that he is part of something greater than himself. That's been with me my whole life. I really don't have the slightest idea what that greater thing is. I'm not a religious person, so I wouldn't put it into some sort of a set of beliefs, but it is something that does give me hope that I am part of something that is larger than myself, and I see that all the time, particularly when I look at into the stars or things like that. So it's not exactly religious, but it's a feeling that we are all part of something much larger than ourselves.
Rob, thanks. Jerry Gutman, you're shaking your head here.
Yeah, I think the author may be Viktor Frankl, actually. Mm-hmm. But
he was.
Yeah, who was in concentration camp. But I think that it is very important to emphasize what the caller just said, in that you don't need to have a well-defined religious belief or faith, but that there are aspects of life where you feel connected and you understand that you are a small being, but in a larger whole, but that larger whole can give meaning to your life. And I think even religious people, Paul Tillich said that the basis of faith is doubt, that, you know, people wrestle with these complexities and don't take things blindly. But that sense of connectedness, which I think Martin Marty talked about earlier mm-hmm, in the mm-hmm. hour, is very important in terms of hope, because you feel you're part of a larger enterprise which is worth contributing to and which will support you when you're in need.
Let's hear from Anne in Weymouth, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi, and happy holiday to everybody.
Thank you. What do you see, Anne? What do you know?
Okay, well, I lived abroad for a few years, and when I go to a different culture, I'm always curious what they're going to teach me, because mm-hmm. I find the American lifestyle to be kind of crazy. But I lived in Lithuania for a few years, and even though they're supposedly a Catholic country, I found that they're not very hopeful. And this was a culture that went against the Soviets. And what I came away with is feeling that hope might be an American concept. Because it was the people would look at me, and when I would say, of course you can do this, or we can do this, or an individual has the possibility and you can change, and they just say, oh, Anna, you know. And
what years, Anne, how long ago was this?
I was there from 99 to 2001,
so not so long ago. And you felt the more fatalism there than in your home country, at least at that time.
Tremendous. And, you know, again, they were under Tsarist rule for 200 years before the Soviets, so there may be a reason for it. But I don't always relate to being what it means to be an American. I haven't quite, you know, determined what that all means to me. But I think one of the things I determined is that we do have a sense of hope and that the individual can make a difference and that things can change and it can be better. And I really kind of, I felt proud. I felt proud that belief system is in me. And it, like I said, it kind of felt like something that Americans have.
Of course, you can find it all over way back centuries ago with Martin Luther in Germany. He said, everything that is done in the world is done by hope. And Anne's feeling it there on the American front. Marty, what about the United States, our particular culture of hope?
Well, I sure hate to take hope captive in the U.S. because a lot of that was optimism. That was easy. Ryan O'Neiber used to say America was a gadget-filled paradise suspended in a hell of international insecurity. And I think one of the cords was cut by 9/11. The other cord was cut now. And all we're doing, really, is joining the rest of the human race. So now we can find out whether that was just optimism and do-good stuff. Now we'll really get to the basics. And I think we're probably getting towards summary time. I would go back to say, on the one level, and we get this from the prophets and Jesus too, hope is helped in the search for justice. Charles Peguy says, let's do everything we can, see to it that people's hopes aren't denied. So you work for justice. But finally, in the most intimate gestures, and I want to go, you're from Boston, I'll quote a Bostonian friend, Peter Berger, who said about transcendence and the larger order of which we're a part. He said, when a child has a nightmare and cries, and the mother wakes up and picks up the child and carries him and walks around a little bit and then pats him on the back and says, they're there, everything's going to be all right, and the child can go back to sleep. Berger says, she is not lying. Now, not everything's going to be all right. He's going to die someday and bad things can happen. But she's meeting the situation of what is now the troubling thing and helping build in that child the confidence that will aid their hope as time passes. Lithuanians are beat down. Everybody gets beat down by tyrannies and totalitarianisms. But I was in Finland recently, and I saw a lot of people who'd been through the Russian side of things. And in the midst of it all, I see many testimonies and stories of hope. And as a Christian, I look for the ways in which that comes about in their particular story of the faith in Jesus and the God of Israel. And that impels them to put some clarity there, but they don't have a monopoly on hope.
Let's get a Buddhist point of view from Chris, calling from Brighton, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. My teacher, Tibetan Buddhist Chogyam Trungpa, spent a lot of time talking about hope and fear as actually both related to each other and both needing to be transcended if you want to open up to what is happening at the moment, to be in the present moment. Part of what keeps us in a cycle of suffering is to constantly try to manipulate our experience to what we think we would like and what we think we should shy away from. And that plays into what we hope for and what we fear. So in order to step out of both of those, we have to sit in meditation and learn how to be actually in the present moment to discover the joy of the present moment, no matter what's presenting itself.
Beyond hope and beyond fear, maybe that's a Buddhist place, and it sounds like you may have found it, Chris. Thanks for that. I mean, at the same time, people want to change the way things are in the world. They want to change them for the better. I mean, Benjamin Franklin says, he that lives upon hope, as in hope only, will die fasting. I love Rita Mae Brown says, never hope more than you work. Like, hope, but get out and do something about it. That's beyond meditation, grant you. That's off the meditation pillow and out in the world. But there's a sense right now, Tom Friedman writing today in the New York Times, we don't just need a bailout in this country. We need to reboot, sort of get out and really work it. Jerome Groopman, do you feel that? We've talked about community today, hope, about the philosophical roots of hope. Do you feel it stirring in this country?
I think so. And I think, you know, it's good to enjoy the moment and you don't always have to be pushing yourself. But on the other hand, particularly at this time I think it's very important to look to the future and to have a very pragmatic, clear-eyed path which does spark hope, because that then, you know, engenders change, real change. There's nothing more vital, you know, for us right now. You know, Roosevelt sparked the exit from the Depression by saying you have nothing to fear but fear itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is important to subsume fear and to see that there can be a path to get us out of the hole that we're in now as a country, economically and to some degree politically.
And Mrs. Roosevelt, Eleanor, saying the future belongs to those who believe in their dreams. Martin, Marty, do you feel something stirring here, something hopeful?
I don't get to meet as many people as I did when I was teaching and a pastor. Sometimes I get it from programs like yours and television and reading. And the first message you always get is from people who've just been robbed of their employment and normal ways of hoping. we Americans have natural hope. That's sort of shattered. But I think picking up those pieces along the way, people do begin to draw closer to each other. They've seen some of the failures in the world of mere consumer life and shopping. And I think that the basics that we started with, the hopes and fears of all the years, meet, and for the Christian, it meets there, and Jews and Muslims and elsewhere, it meets somewhere else.
Martin, Marty, but, Jerome Groopman with that, we're out of time. Whether over menorah or Christmas tree, good hopes to all of you. Thanks for joining us.